coming up on Path to Zero.
We can tap reliable, affordable energy and clean energy, but only if we're willing to make these long-term infrastructure investments.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, President and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, Path to Zero listeners. In this episode, we're talking about reliability, affordability, and the people behind the power system. Our guest is Becky Klein, president of Klein Energy, former chair of the Public Utility Commission of Texas, and founder of the Texas Energy Poverty Research Institute. She spent decades working across energy, utilities, water, national security, and public policy. Today, she serves on the boards of several major energy and water companies. We'll talk about how boardroom conversations are changing, what she sees ahead for the grid, and why addressing energy poverty is so important. Becky, welcome to Path to Zero. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Well, I'm excited to be here, and I've been looking forward to it also. Thank you.
Good. We have a lot of ground to cover today, but I think let's start from the very beginning because you've got such a great experience. You worked across energy policy. You worked for utilities. You know a lot about national security and have done it for a good while. How have all those experiences shaped the way you think about today's challenges in the energy space?
I'd say first 25 years in the Air Force taught me that the most complex missions succeed when you have clear objectives and disciplined execution and the ability to adapt in real time. So I had the opportunity to see firsthand how critical infrastructure vulnerabilities can cascade into national security risks. And that's something that's become really core to grid planning today. So when you combine that with leading Texas through electricity restructuring as the Public Utility Commission chairman, you develop a particular lens. I look at energy challenges through three filters. First, operational reliability. Second, economic efficiency. And the third is social equity. So the military taught me where you can't compromise on mission critical systems. The regulatory environment and working with utilities taught me that markets need the right signals and the rules to function. And then founding the Energy Poverty Institute taught me that if your grid doesn't serve everyone, you haven't actually solved the problem. So those three perspectives are increasingly inseparable and co-joined in today's energy landscape. And I recognize that it is a very delicate balancing act where if you move one lever, it affects the others.
Yeah, that's so true. And as you think about, I mean, I'm glad you said that you chair the Public Utility Commission of Texas. It's a daunting job. And I'd love to hear stories of your years in that role. But as you look at the grid, maybe in those early days and in the grid now, what do you think has been the most significant change?
First, I think there's two things that come to mind. One is the speed of change that we're working with and dealing with today. And the other is the complexity of the reliability equation. So, for example, in the late 90s and early 2000s, we were designing market structures for a relatively predictable system. We had mostly thermal generation. We had manageable load growth, and we understood weather patterns. The challenge back then was more economic. So how do you create competition while maintaining reliability was the basic problem set. Today, however, the variables, the number of variables has exploded. We're seeing unprecedented load growth from data centers, manufacturing, electrification generally. We have inverter-based resources like wind and solar and batteries that behave completely different than traditional synchronous generation like gas plants or coal plants or others. Weather volatility that stress tests the system in ways that we've never modeled. And then you overlay all of that with geopolitical dynamics that affect everything from equipment supply chains to natural gas prices to grid security. So over the last 25 years, I would say we moved from a world of predictable baseload to a world of weather-driven reliability, which requires a much more sophisticated set of tools to manage all that. But, you know, Tucker, I would say that here is what has not changed. The physics of the grid doesn't negotiate. So you still need real-time balance on the grid. You still need inertia on the grid and voltage support on the grid. You still need firm capacity when customers need it. The market structure we built assumed those would be solved through economic signals. So today we're learning which signals work with more of these variables I mentioned and which need to be recalibrated.
In terms of the generation makeup, you've really led the charge, I think, in the nation for blending solar, wind. Maybe now you're starting to add batteries, of course, with your other baseload plants that were so heavily driven by natural gas. Do you feel good today about just the generation capacity in Texas? Would you, if you were going to give them a grade, would you A to F, what would you, well, how would you grade just generation capacity?
You know, as far as the capacity of generation, I would give it an A today. Now, ask me that in 3 to 5 years, based on the fact that we're experiencing so much more demand growth. And will that generation resource be available in 3 to 5 years in the amount that we need it? So today we're A. In 3 to 5 years, let's see where we're at. I think too that we really have to look at, you know, capacity and make sure that we're not pretending that nameplate capacity is equivalent to reliable capacity. So, for example, a gigawatt of solar doesn't perform like a gigawatt of gas when you need it at night on a hot August evening. So whether it's ERCOT here in Texas or other independent system operators around the nation, we're all moving towards performance-based frameworks about, you know, what type of performance characteristic a particular resource brings to the table and when and how we need and in what amounts we need to incense that. And so we're all working for clear capacity accreditation that reflects what the grid actually needs today and tomorrow. So that means incentives that will value dispatchability or a duration of a resource being on the grid and other reliability services. So it's not just having capacity, it's having the right kind of capacity for our emerging transmission and distribution grid of the future.
Yeah, I would love to come back and kind of talk about you. You mentioned it early, and it's just too complex to talk about in a 30-minute podcast. But that combination of what I call flywheel power, you know, natural gas, coal, those big combined generation type plants, and then those intermittent sources like solar, wind, it's horrifically complex to balance if you are the grid, if you're the grid operator. But let me ask. So I love the fact that you give Texas an A in generation. How about for the interconnects and the transmission lines and all of the infrastructure past generation? Would you give Texas an A there as well?
Well, when you compare Texas's interconnection process with other areas of the nation, we rise to the surface. We do it faster and easier. And the reason is that, you know, because of what you mentioned earlier, Tucker, we're our own grid system and we don't interconnect with other states' grid systems. So we could be more nimble. But the other reason is because I think our permitting structures are more flat and they are welcoming to business. So if you're a generator or you're a large load customer, your permitting requirements, whether it's water, air, you know, workforce issues, are more streamlined and dynamic than in other states. So all that combined, we have, you know, a good interconnection process. However, that doesn't mean that it doesn't need to be improved. It definitely does, and would love to talk about that more granularly at the appropriate time.
Well, yeah, we have, because I agree with you, Texas has done so well. And I do think that's a part of the whole economic development rush to Texas is you have land, you have power, you have a workforce, you have the right political environment. And as I kind of translate that, so for example, I live in the PJM area and I would make none of those similar grades in PJM, right? I would say our generation capacity is at best a C. Our interconnects are probably C minus. And I'm not sure, as I look across all of the other balancing authorities around the country, I see that they will ever be as efficient as Texas just because of the bureaucracy that surrounds them. You got FERC dipping in, you've got their own balancing authority, you got often multiple states with multiple agendas. But as I look at this and try to kind of predict, how do we get out of this, meaning a reliable, affordable grid? I don't really see a solution sometimes as I look past some of those single states like Texas. Do you have any different, you have thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, on a national level, I think there's three things. The first is permitting reform and cost allocation. So today we're stuck in a 1970s process trying to solve 2026 problems. And where we've seen that certain projects can take a decade or more from concept to completion. So we need federal state coordination that actually works. And I know since I've been involved in this industry, there's always been efforts at federal state coordination. And I think at some point we really need to, and now is the time when we're on the cusp of huge demand growth, that this is more essential now than ever before. We need clearer rules on who pays for those regional benefits and recognition that transmission is seen and valued not just as a cost, but as insurance against much larger reliability failures. So permitting reform is, you know, a number one nationally. And then I would say rate design incentive mechanisms that align with your desired performance outcomes. So if we want customers to use energy differently, if we want them to shift load or to invest in efficiency or to enable demand response, well, then rates need to reflect the actual system costs for that. So time of use pricing, demand charges for certain users, interruptible rates for flexible loads, all need to be on the table in a new way. But this has to be done carefully to avoid harming vulnerable populations, which is where research like the Energy Poverty Institute in Texas becomes essential. So I think the bottom line is we can have reliable, affordable energy and clean energy, but only if we're willing to make these long-term infrastructure investments efficiently and properly value their reliability attributes and, you know, look at designing markets that reflect the physics of resources rather than just wishful thinking, if you will.
That's a great answer. And one, when I'm always hopeful when people like you are beginning to engage in that space, because it's going to take a lot of bright minds working together. All right, let's move to a subject that I'm sure is near and dear to your heart, because you founded the Texas Energy Poverty Research Institute. I think you call it TEPRI quite a bit. So when you founded TEPRI, what were the problems you were trying to solve, and why is TEPRI so important today?
Well, TEPRI was founded 10 years ago in 2015. And at that time, I saw a gap in the data. We had comprehensive data on megawatt hours and market pricing, but there was almost no systematic research on who couldn't afford to keep their lights on and why. Energy poverty 10 years ago was not on anybody's tongue. No one was really talking about it. And it's not just about low income. It's about so much more. It's about the quality of housing stock. It's about rate design. It's about disconnection policies. It's about healthcare needs and mortality. It's about economic mobility. So, for example, a family spending 15 to 20% of their income on electricity or energy, they can't invest in education or healthcare for their family or themselves very easily. And that's not just a utility issue, it's an economic development issue. So TEPRI became the state's first research institute dedicated to understanding these dynamics with analytical rigor. And why is it important now? Because we're asking households to absorb significant cost, whether it's grid modernization or weatherization or the energy transition or the energy addition, whichever way you want to call it. And if we don't understand the affordability impacts, we'll design policies that fail politically, and they'll hurt the people we're trying to help. So the data we've generated is meant to help inform everything from rate case testimony to legislative policy to utility program design, because ultimately you can't manage what you don't measure.
What are some of the most important accomplishments or even insights you've learned from this last 10 years of work?
Yeah, so it's an exciting point in time for the organization because we've spent 10 years of doing some very deep granular research across the entire state. And now what we're really eager to do is put our findings and research into play and make them actionable. So some of the insights that we've discovered is that energy poverty isn't just about the bill. It's about the home and about how individuals relate to their energy use. So our research shows that there are many low-income residents in Texas who live in energy sieves. Their homes are so inefficient that no amount of subsidy can fix the problem. But we're moving the needle in various ways. So, for example, we're working with manufacturers that will integrate solar into their tiny homes that they're building, or by evaluating and identifying where targeted investments can make the most difference, like networked distribution energy resources in the home. So like having a battery in your home for both resiliency and how can that play towards affordability. We are working with a major data center to understand and build community resiliency hubs for low and moderate income people so that there's a place that they could go when there is natural disaster or they're having some economic burden that's acute. They have a place to go to be able to plug in their phone, for example, and other things. And we're studying other technologies as well that can act as both a grid stabilizer, but equally importantly, it can also be an affordability solution. So I think what we're discovering is that this is the age of new technologies coming to the fore that are able to start addressing both that reliability and affordability problem set.
And those solutions you talk about generally, I mean, and I love talking about Texas because it's a fairly efficient model. Would those solutions most likely come from government or would they come from the utility providers? Or perhaps both?
Well, you know, in Texas, we're seeing some of these solutions come from, you know, emerging startup companies, technology companies that are doing some of this. And, or we're looking at, you know, other major players that have the capacity to put new technologies or new projects into play. So, you know, we're seeing it more coming from the outside, from the private sector, from creative new minds that want to tackle the problem head on.
We'll have more with Becky Klein in just a moment. Stay with us.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane, energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back. Our guest today is Becky Klein, and we're talking about the future of the grid, energy affordability, and the changing energy mix. We're going to touch your third hat. We've touched your first hat as chairman of the Public Utility Commission of Texas. We talked about Texas energy poverty research, but you know, one doesn't have to study you much to realize you have a pretty good representation on various boards, and those boards could be electric utilities, gas utilities, water utilities. I mean, all of those are really strong issues in Texas. But talk about those conversations you're seeing now in the boardroom. Maybe is it a different conversation than it was 5 years ago? Or what are boards, whether it's an electric, water, or gas board, what's pertinent to them today?
So what's pertinent is, first off, I think the conversations around the boardroom on these issues have gone from sequential to simultaneous. So by that, I mean 5 years ago, boards might discuss reliability in one meeting. They may discuss rate impacts in another, you know, because of the financial aspects of it. And they may discuss cybersecurity quarterly. But today, most major decisions touch all three and then some. And they're often in tension. So, for example, at Avista, which is a electric power and gas utility in the Pacific Northwest, we're navigating wildfire risk, source adequacy in the Pacific Northwest, clean energy mandates, and affordability all simultaneously. And they touch in various different aspects of the utility. So not only concerning operational risk, financial risk, those kind of conversations even make their way into the compensation committee. And, you know, we may have metrics for our executive officers and CEO on some of these things. So that's one example. At Diamondback Energy, that's an oil and gas producer in the Permian Basin. So the conversation there is about energy security, methane management, meeting the growing energy demand while oil and gas remains essential to the U.S. and to the world. And, you know, what are the tensions of all that? And the, you know, keeping it low cost. At H2O America, that's a water utility that has various subsidiaries across the United States. And there, the water energy nexus issues are front and center because data centers and industrial facilities require massive amounts of both water and energy. And that's all while we're trying to keep water rates affordable as we are replacing old water pipes or upgrading treatment plants and water tanks and trying to pay for the development of new water resources. So, you know, that's why I say it's going from kind of linear sequential to simultaneously conversation. And I would say too, while there's that, the security dimension has fundamentally shifted. So it's no longer, no matter what the company, it's no longer just physical security or cybersecurity. It's supply chain resilience. It's geopolitical risk from equipment manufacturing. It's workforce shortages and the vulnerability of an increasingly interconnected grid. So those things are really becoming more manifest. And the boards I serve on are asking harder and harder questions. Can we actually build what we've planned for or what we need to plan for? Do we have the transmission and distribution equipment? Do we have the labor? What the permit timelines, how are they changing? The equipment inventory. So these aren't hypothetical risks anymore. They're constraints that are binding today. And the affordability question is unavoidable. Customers see the bills. And if we can't explain why costs are rising faster than inflation, and they are, then we lose that social license to operate. So that undergirds everything right now, whereas it hadn't really been part of the mix 5 years ago.
That's a fascinating answer. Thank you for that. So, well, just a couple quick questions for you as we kind of start thinking about wrapping up. Where do you see the most important investments going on right now in the energy space? Where are you tracking what we'll call a quality investment?
You know, I think right now it's transmission and distribution, because ultimately our growth is stymied by transmission and distribution build out. It's the bottleneck, both for reliability and for unlocking new generation and for unlocking new load. So, you know, the nation is facing a fundamental challenge. We have generation and large load interconnection requests that are unprecedented in both the amount and the size, but the transmission constraints, and soon even the distribution constraints, prevent us from integrating even a fraction of that amount. So you're seeing this already drive investments in new grid enhancing technologies and dynamic line ratings and other technologies that are basically trying to squeeze more capacity out of existing infrastructure while we wait for new build to occur. So I think that's probably the number one best allocation of a dollar. But I will tell you that what's so fun and interesting and necessary is projects that stand out to me anyway, are those that have the potential to solve the triple conundrum, providing reliable, clean, and affordable powers, the triple conundrum. So those kind of projects, such as batteries, both at the commercial scale for commercial industrial uses, but batteries also for residential use at the distribution level, battery plus solar combinations, gas plants that are going to be near zero emission, or even new nuclear technologies. I think those are also very important areas to allocate resources in order to be able to meet the demands of the electricity that we're going to be expecting to use.
You know, you talked a lot about solar, wind, batteries, nat gas. I guess we'll imply in there we can include nuclear, both fusion and fission, probably. Is there anything that you think gets left behind in the last? I mean, we talk a lot about all of the above. I'm quick to say I don't believe in all of the above. Some things probably need to get left behind. Does anything get left behind in the next 5 to 10 years, you think?
Yeah, I do. I think, for example, you know, the short-lived heyday of hydrogen, that needs to get left behind for now, because I don't think the amount of capital it takes for the value that it provides is really where we're at today. So I think that's one big one that gets left behind. I am so glad that we have private sector that has the deep pockets to be able to invest in fusion. But, you know, over my career span in the energy and electricity space, I've heard repeatedly that we're going to see that commercialized in the next 10 years. And we're still hearing that mantra. And, you know, we're like 40 years past that mantra that I've heard. So it's hard for me, especially as a non-scientist, to really understand the veracity of that.
It would be my second fight of the day over when fusion is real, because I'm with you. It's just hard. And I love technology, so I really want to believe that technology will get there. And I do believe it will get there, but don't feel like it's going to be there in the very near future at all. That's good. All right,
Tucker, I do worry that there's one thing that will get left behind that shouldn't get left behind. And that's workforce development. You can authorize grid projects, but if you don't have the line workers, engineers, skilled trades to build them, those investment dollars will just sit idle. So workforce development is super important.
Yeah, they need to be trained. They need to be motivated. That's everywhere I travel, that is top of mind. And, you know, I'm coming out of a period where we were kind of at the mercy of snow and ice for the better part of a month. So you really learn to appreciate the workforce like linemen who go out in the middle of the night in weather that I don't want to leave my house, and they're working. It's such a critical area that we do have a trained workforce. And I've got to ask you one question, because you got perspective based on years in policy, but also, you know, years in the private sector. You sit in Texas. You're the intersection of tremendous growth, tremendous strain on the grid. All these things are happening. You got politicians talking about affordability. You talk a lot about affordability, reliability, availability. Where is the intersection of technology and policy? What are some of the most relevant tools to make sure that we do get back to an affordable, reliable grid? And I think you've mentioned it, but I'd love just to are there policy levers you want to pull? Are there technology levers you pull? Or what are just one or two of those key thoughts?
You know, it's always been the case where technology is always ahead of policy and pushes the policy envelope. And we're certainly seeing that today. You know, I'm just thinking about one particular company here in Texas that has gone great guns, and they're certainly pushing the policy envelope. That company is called Base Power, and so they provide residences with battery power at their home, like Tesla did. And they network them. So when I need power because the grid is off, I have that for, you know, up to 12 hours or more, depending on how I use my electricity. But when I don't need it, then the grid is getting more power that my battery is selling into the grid. And that's also allowing my retail rate to go down and providing capacity in the grid. So that has multi-use benefits, not just for the customer, but also for the grid itself. And for different customers. So technologies like that can also provide more capacity on the grid, so that maybe a large load, maybe there's a manufacturing plant, maybe there's a hyperscaler of some sort that needs to get up and running. So, but the transmission grid doesn't have the capacity for it. Well, this particular technology can back off low residential load in an aggregated way to enable that large load to then get on the grid faster. So there's that. And there's technologies, you know, that we're seeing with thermostats and houses that are networked that are a lot more agile and user-friendly. And, you know, if we each individually opt into that program, then we could see our energy usage managed by someone else and managed in a comfortable way, but also in a more affordable way. So, you know, those are just a couple of examples. I think we're starting to see more and more 3D printed homes that are more affordable and also much more energy efficient. And so if we could start seeing creative financing come into play with that for low and medium income households that don't have the credit that you and I would, I think that is probably the next frontier as well.
That's fascinating. Thank you. All right, we have a little fun on Path to Zero. So we're going to hand you a magic wand. We love magic. It's not limited just to Harry Potter, thankfully. And you get to use that magic wand for one thing over the next year that you think will have the biggest impact.
Okay, well, I'll get on my current mantra, which I am so passionate about right now. And if I had a magic wand, I would wave that wand over every single electric utility in the nation and make them instant centers of operational excellence through having them look internally and contemporizing their workflows, their business processes, reinventing team interaction in order to enable dynamic work design. So I'm not saying that they aren't good now, but I do see that step change improvement is vital. So because utilities across the nation are facing unprecedented infrastructure investment cycle, I mean, there have been estimates of potentially $1.4 trillion over the next 5 years of investment. So they're having to navigate that while confronting explosive load growth, as we talked about, complex interconnection requests and heightened regulatory scrutiny. So in this environment, internal operational efficiency isn't just a back office concern. It has to be the foundation upon which everything else depends. And there's various reasons for a utility to prioritize cost engineering internally. I have my top three reasons that I'll just mention quickly. One is regulatory stability. Because every dollar of operational inefficiency flows through to rate cases. Commissions should be increasingly skeptical of cost recovery requests when utilities can't demonstrate that they've optimized their own processes. If they have bloated procurement process, duplicative engineering reviews, regulators need to question whether payers should fund new infrastructure when existing operations aren't lean or efficient. So that's one. Maybe I'll stick with just two, and that is back to affordability, the cost structure for affordability. So the only suitable path to absorbing these unprecedented infrastructure costs while maintaining affordable rates is radical operational efficiency. If internal operations consume unnecessary costs and time, those costs compound across every project and every customer class. So if utility can cost engineer their operations, that creates some headroom in order to absorb necessary infrastructure investments without triggering affordability crisis. So I think ultimately at the heart of it, a utility that hasn't optimized its internal cost structure and work processes is essentially asking customers to fund both operational inefficiency and infrastructure expansion at the same time. So that's neither economically sustainable and it's not defensible on a regulatory basis if they don't start doing something about it now. You know, it reminds me of the Mayo Clinic and MD Anderson. They went through a total internal reinvention. So they now treat the patient experience as a science. So utilities can do the same thing. They can't just say they care about their customer. They have to re-engineer the physical and digital processes to both protect reliability while they're meeting the customer where the customer is at, just like MD Anderson and Mayo Clinic did. And so that's what I would love to see with the magic wand.
Sometimes we go back and listen to these answers, and I would say across the board, they're all fascinating, but that is a great use of the wand. And I think one that transcends well beyond the utility industry about, you know, working on operational excellence. As we think about the new tools in front of us and whether we're actually using them to be better to the customer, maybe be more affordable. Great use of your wand. All right. Last question for you. We would love to plant a tree in honor of your time and expertise, this conversation today in a national forest, in any place of your choosing. Is there a national forest or a favorite place that you would love to have a tree planted?
Wow, that's a hard one. But, okay, I do have a favorite outdoor space, and that is Klein Vineyard Ranch. So that would be Dale and my Klein Vineyard, which is about an hour outside of Austin. And it's a, its brand is KVR Wines. So it has breathtaking scenic hill country views. We have 2 miles of tree-lined winding roads that lead you to our vineyards that are sprawling out on the sloping foot of our hills. And I would wish for something to be planted there for KVR wine lovers to enjoy. It could be another tree on our winding road, or better yet, it could be planting a grapevine. In fact, we're planting 2 acres of our very first white grape varietal this April.
I'm sure, and accommodating your request. So thank you so much. Becky Klein, it's been so nice to have you on Path to Zero. We could talk for another couple hours, but I think we'll save it for another day. But thank you for sharing so much of what you know with us on Path to Zero today.
Thank you, Tucker. It's a privilege.
We appreciate Becky Klein joining us today and sharing her perspective on the future of energy. If you enjoyed this podcast of Path to Zero, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app or YouTube and leave us a review. It really helps us grow the show. You can also find these conversations along with articles and insights on the Path to Zero Substack. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Path to Zero.